Well, as we are continuing our study in the Gospel of John, you may notice we are not in John chapter 1. We are in chapter 18, and we are going to be dealing with not the incarnation, but the reason for the incarnation, Christ's giving of himself in a sacrificial provision for us. And so in our study of John's gospel, we are moving from the religious trials to the civil trials of Jesus. Last time we had looked at Jesus before Annas in particular, and we remember that the religious trials were before Annas, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin, though John only dealt with Annas in particular, referenced Caiaphas. The other synoptic gospels deal with the other details there. But what we recognize is this was the case of having a trial before his own people, the Jews. And as John tells us in John chapter 1, they knew him not. They didn't recognize him for who he was. The civil trials are before Pilate. There are three here as well. Before Pilate, and then Herod Antipas, and then Pilate again. And these were the powers that be at the time, the political authorities. And so they had significance as well. There was a reason why it went the way it did, which we will be touching on and have given some consideration to previously. John reported much more about Jesus' trial before Pilate than did any of the other gospel writers. He did not refer to the appearance before Herod Antipas, which only Luke recorded, Luke 23:6-12, because it was particularly inconsequential. It really didn't mean a whole lot practically. He stressed Jesus' authority, particularly his authority as Israel's king, but also his universal kingship. So that's an emphasis that John is pointing out, and that relates to the incarnation event because, again, it's part of the reason he is here, and he's going to point that out a little bit as well. And then John apparently assumed that his readers knew of the other gospel accounts of Jesus' passion, and this supports the view that John's gospel was the latest one written, sometimes after the fact. And so he's kind of filling in some details with a particular emphasis on letting people know who Jesus is and why you ought to believe in him, as we pointed out before as well. The other gospels seem to stress the legal aspects of this trial, but John presents it more as sort of an interview between Jesus and Pilate, kind of like some of his other interviews, like with Nicodemus, chapter 3, the Samaritan woman, chapter 4, the blind man, chapter 9. And so we see that's kind of how John tends to communicate, and it gives us a little more of a narrative sense of things. Jesus is again presented as ultimately in control of the situation. That has been the way John has communicated things. The reason is he's emphasizing his deity. He is the Son of God. He is the Messiah, the Savior, and you ought to take him at his word and believe who he is, who Christ is, as is communicated here. So while Pilate was the political authority, the one that was sort of over this area under Rome's authority, Jesus had the real and ultimate authority. And John seems to be wanting to communicate that. And while Pilate was in his own comfortable surroundings, at least it was a place where he frequented, he wasn't always stationed there, Jesus was displaced from his former, what we would consider, comfortable surroundings. He left heaven's glory. He became man in the incarnation, became one of us. And so he wasn't exactly in the most comfortable position. I can't imagine leaving heaven's glory and coming to this. I mean, I know there are places where it's really nice and beautiful and all of that, but when you're dumped in with a bunch of crazy people like us and others, then it's a little bit more of a challenge. So what is it that we can learn from these circumstances? We want to keep our thoughts open to what we ought to consider in this. So the first thing we want to think about is the request for accusations against Jesus. looking at verses 28 and 29. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and it was early morning. So, giving you a little bit of a time frame, it had been at night, and then this has been going on through the night, and now it's early morning, after the occasion of visiting with Annas and Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. But they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. We'll have to think about what exactly does that mean. Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man? Why is he here? Why are you bothering me early in the morning? I've got better things to do. I haven't finished my coffee. My bagel's getting cold. Come on, let's go." That might contextualize a little bit so you can relate to what he's struggling with here. There were mixed signals being sent that were coming from the Jewish leaders here. The desperate accusers now move to the next level. The Jewish authorities led Jesus from the jurisdiction of Caiaphas, where we had Annas, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin, to the jurisdiction of Pilate, the civil trial. So there's a movement like, okay, we're starting off at this level, now we're going to go to the next level. They had already pronounced judgment on Jesus and condemned him for blasphemy. Matthew 27, 1 and 2, Mark 15, 1, Luke 22, 66 to 71 communicate the details of that. And blasphemy was a capital offense in Israel. Leviticus 24, 16 tells us this. But the Sanhedrin could not pass the death sentence for this offense without Roman governmental approval or agreement. And there was little hope of Pilate doing that because he couldn't care less whether there was blasphemy going on. He'd be happy to contribute to it if he had occasion. So that wasn't going to fly. So therefore, the Jewish leaders decided to charge Jesus with sedition against Rome. Now that would get Pilate's attention. You're going to go up against Rome. Okay, now we're going to deal with you. So they had to change their tactic just a little bit. They had gone through what they thought for them was going to be a sufficient accusation, but that wasn't going to fly with Pilate. And they were exceedingly determined to get Jesus eliminated pretty much at all costs. So they would say and do whatever they needed to. But did they realize who was playing them? Did they realize that they were instruments in the hands of the devil at this time? And these were the religious leaders. Did they realize that something was wrong with their actions? Did they not sense it? Why would they not see it? Well, we know they were blinded in their self-righteousness, which is easy to happen to us as well. The location of this event warrants some explanation. The term Praetorium is a Latin word meaning either the headquarters of the commanding officer of a Roman military camp or a Roman military governor's headquarters, as was the case here. Pilate was this kind of governor. And the Gospels use the more generic term governor, though technically Pilate would have been the prefect of Judah or the procurator, as the historian Tacitus identified him. Pilate's normal headquarters would have been in Caesarea. That would have been the capital of the Roman province of Judea, which was just a bit of a distance to the north and right on the Mediterranean. It would have been nicer there. We had palm trees. They could chill out, you know. Wouldn't have to work so hard as it would be in Jerusalem, where there was these hard-headed Jewish people to have to deal with. And that's often how they thought of it. So, but during the Jewish feast times, Pilate would come to Jerusalem along with the Roman troops, as we'd referenced, to discourage uprisings, because you get that many people together, particularly people who didn't want to be under Roman rule, You never know what they might come up with, and so they had to have a presence, a Roman presence there. So that's why they were there whenever there was an influx of people coming to Jerusalem. And the headquarters in Jerusalem was either Herod's former palace on the western wall of the city or in the fortress Antonio, immediately north of the temple enclosure. The traditional site is the fortress of Antonio, which has been understood as the beginning of the Via Dolorosa, the Way of Sorrow, that Jesus traveled from the Praetorium to Golgotha. However, most modern commentators believe Pilate probably interviewed Jesus in Herod's former palace. He would just come and take it over. That's kind of how things operated. And so the soldiers may have been holed up in the Fortress Antonio, but it's been suggested that perhaps Pilate would have been utilizing the palace of Herod, at least his former palace. The accusing Jews wanted to avoid ceremonial defilement and remained outside the praetorium, because the Jews thought that entering a Gentile's dwelling made them ceremonially unclean. We saw that referenced in Acts chapter 10, verse 28, with Peter's situation. This was because Gentiles had no reason to be concerned about taking precautions to guarantee a kosher situation, as the Jews did. They just wouldn't think that way. They had no reason to. Because the Gentiles, in the mind of the Jews, they would probably have yeast in their homes, and that would have made participation in the Passover festivities problematic, and they would have been viewing that as unlawful. They could not do that, and that therefore the Jews did not want to defile themselves if they entered into the dwelling without all of the leaven being scrupulously removed. So ironically, these Jews were taking extreme precautions to avoid this defilement, while at the same time were preparing to murder the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Now, isn't that problematic? You're worried about a little bit of leaven, but you're not worried about murder. It's interesting that they were so anxious to avoid this external defilement, to observe a festival whose real significance, stemming back to the time of the deliverance from Egypt, but was pointing forward to the sacrifice of the true Passover lamb. Isn't that interesting? If you think about it in those terms, it's just amazing. This sacrifice would bring an end to all of the distinctions that they were focusing on, the ceremonially clean and unclean, because it would provide an inner cleansing, which was needed. And it was the death of the true Passover lamb that the Jews at this moment are anxious to bring about. Also, these Jews, with their superficial commitment to the Mosaic law, found it more difficult for them to truly obey that law, because in the intricacies of what they were trying to focus on, they were missing the spirit of the law in the process. And so their obsessive focus on the law, in the way that they were thinking of it, actually separated them from the one who was actually going to give them freedom from that law. So we also observe in the process here, in terms of the sort of the historical context, that Pilate was going between the inside of his headquarters to the outside of his headquarters to talk to the Jews, and then to come back in and talk to Jesus. And we've noted earlier that Jesus ate the Passover with his disciples in the upper room on the previous evening. And so this brings to mind why these Jews were concerned that entering Pilate's praetorium might preclude them from eating the Passover if Jesus and his disciples had already eaten it the night before. Had they too not already eaten it themselves? So with that in mind, we need to think about, okay, what was in view when they were talking about eating the Passover? Was it that part of it, or was it what's coming next? If they would think about the whole celebration here with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it was probably that they were anticipating, wanting to be able to participate in the entire festival, not just the Passover itself, but everything else. And so they wanted to maintain their lack of defilement, if you will, in the process. So it was to be able to continue to participate in this 8-day festival that they may have had in mind, that they did not want to defile themselves from any further participation in it. Then Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" That was his major concern. That was the issue that he needed to deal with. In other words, he's saying, "Why are you bothering me with this guy? Is there something really significant here? It's early in the morning. You're pestering me." There was a question regarding accusations. Pilate was in a rather difficult political situation. He needed to please his supervisors, those that were over him, and do the right thing. But he also couldn't afford to upset the Jews because he needed to keep the peace. That's why he was there. He also wanted to promote his own position, his own authority among them. He wanted to look good. He didn't want to end up looking bad. So how do you do that in that kind of a situation? It wasn't the easiest place to be. Pilate evidently addressed the Jews who had assembled outside his headquarters, whether it was he just would go outside or whether he was in a balcony looking over, which is what is pictured here. It's hard to find when you're looking for a photo that points out the situation as I think Scripture is indicating here, but this may be as close as you can find. But basically, the Jews here were practicing what we had to practice since COVID-19 hit, that is social distancing. So it might help to think of it in those terms. Pilate wanted to know their formal charge. What accusation do you have against Jesus? He probably knew something of Jesus' arrest since the Roman soldiers had participated in it. We assume that the high priest had communicated to Pilate about Jesus, and so there was some understanding of it. Besides, Jesus was a popular figure in Galilee and in Jerusalem. There should have been some awareness of that. So he's probably not totally in the dark on what's going on. But he also needed to have some formal charges. You can't just bring somebody here and say, "We don't like this guy, get rid of him." That's not going to fly. Because there was formal Roman due process. There was jurisdiction that Pilate had in this area, but he was obligated to follow the law, and for the law there had to be legitimate charges. You have to have some reason for bringing a charge against someone. Then looking at verses 30 to 32, they answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you. Who do you think we are? We're not a bunch of bozos." Then Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die." What does that mean? By what death he would die? You have to think about that. The confrontation seemed to get a little testy. The Jews stated they would not bring an innocent person to him. Basically, they were saying, "Trust us. Take our word for it. You know us. We're good people. We would never do anything wrong." The spokesmen for the Jews were essentially evading Pilate's question. Luke recorded that they initially charged Jesus with misleading Israel, with forbidding the Jews to pay their taxes to Caesar, and with claiming to be Israel's king. That's Luke 23, verse 2. However, they would not be able to impress Pilate sufficiently with those charges, so they hesitated to bring the charge of blasphemy because they had good reason to believe that Pilate would dismiss it as unworthy of his consideration. And they evidently didn't want to accuse him of treason because that may have incited many of his followers and they would have difficulty proving it anyway. So they did not name the charge. They assumed it was serious, and they implied that Pilate should trust them and rubber stamp their decision. I mean, we wouldn't bring them to you if it wasn't a good reason. So perhaps the fact that Pilate had provided troops to arrest Jesus encouraged the Jews to think that he already was on their side. He already was thinking in their direction, and that he already had judged Jesus to be guilty. But they may have been a little ahead of themselves. And they didn't appreciate Pilate's question, since it suggested that they would have to go through a formal trial from beginning to end. They didn't want to go through a whole due process and deal with all of that. You know how long a trial takes? I mean, they wanted this done today. They'd already come to their conclusions, and it's possible that they were taken a bit by surprise at Pilate's indication that he would want to try Jesus himself. They had had his cooperation in making the arrest. Now they expected him to simply take their word for it. And they needed that rubber stamp, that Roman stamp on things to make it happen, in order to get what they wanted. They wanted their way, and that was Jesus dead. And that's a concern, because there are many issues involved with that. And Pilate seemed to realize that the Jewish leaders had determined to do away with Jesus, but he had no evidence that Jesus had done anything worthy of death from the Roman perspective. And it was true, he hadn't. And I think he recognized that there was some element of envy on the part of the Jewish leaders as well. Pilate tried to push the matter back on the Jews. He reasoned that it was their own internal matter and that they should take care of it themselves in proper fashion, but they should be able to just handle it. And since the Jews did not charge Jesus formally before Pilate, they didn't have any really good excuses or rationale or reason or accusation, there was nothing Pilate could do except to hand him back to them and say, hey, you guys take care of it. This is out of my area. And the Jews explained why that was unacceptable to them, because they were not permitted to put anyone to death, and they were determined to do that. They wanted Jesus executed, but they didn't have the authority to execute him themselves. One commentator said this: the Pilate disclosed in the ancient historical documents almost certainly acted like this, not so much out of any passion for justice as out of the ego-building satisfaction he gained from making the Jewish authorities jump through legal hoops and recognize his authority. And that's kind of the impression you get from reading the other Gospels as well. He was more concerned about himself, his situation, than he was the Jews and their internal problems. And that's understandable, because he wasn't a Jew. He didn't want to think about those things and said, just deal with it yourself. The Jews explained their judicial and political problem. And John noted that the Jews' admission that they could not put anyone to death was in harmony with God's plan for the situation as well. Jesus had predicted that he would die by crucifixion, not by stoning, because he'd be lifted up. And the Romans were the only ones that were authorized to put a person to death by crucifixion. The Jews did stone people to death for blasphemy. You think back to Acts chapter 6, verse 11, and chapter 7, 58, with the stoning of Stephen. But those seem to be instances of mob violence rather than independent legal action. They probably also wanted Jesus crucified because the Mosaic law regarded such a death as proof of God's curse. Anyone that's lifted up on a tree is cursed. And they may have been willing to let that happen. And we recognize that, ironically, the death that the Jewish hierarchy regarded as a final negation of Jesus' claims became the means of justification apart from the law. They were thinking they were following the law, and yet what Jesus was going to do was to basically put away the law in the way that they had been accustomed to it. So it was necessary for three reasons for Jesus to be crucified by the Romans at the instigation of the Jews. It was to fulfill prophecies that none of his bones would be broken, to include, because his bones might be broken if you're throwing stones, particularly some of the bigger ones that are out there. It was to include both Jews and Gentiles in the collective guilt for the deed, because all are guilty, ultimately. And by crucifixion, Jesus was lifted up like the snake in the desert, John 3:14. And when we look at this, I'm kind of appalled at the stubborn behavior of these Jews. And yet we're grateful for the result. Isn't that kind of an ironic thing to think about? And we think, what were these people thinking? And yet they made happen, by their participation, what was necessary for our salvation. But we also know how easily one can be misled by various factors from seeing the truth that they were missing and then properly acting on it. And, of course, the matter of truth is going to come up again. The request for clarification from Jesus in looking at verses 33 to 36. Then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus, and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." What is he talking about there? Is there not going to be a real kingdom? Is it not worldly? Is it not earthly in any sense? What is involved with that? So the question of the kingly identity of Jesus is considered here. The stated charges of the Jews prompted further questions. So Pilate returned to the inside of his headquarters to interrogate Jesus, and he asked Jesus if he was claiming to be the king of the Jews. Since the messianic expectation was running high at this time, in particular during Jesus' day, many people were saying that Jesus was the Messiah, and he had communicated that, particularly to the woman at the well, very clearly. The Jewish leaders had charged Jesus with claiming to be this king, Luke 23:2. Now Pilate wanted to hear if Jesus himself claimed to be this king. "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered in the affirmative. The synoptics report Jesus replying, "It is as you say." And it's the same answer, basically, that John gives in verse 37, but he included additional conversation first before he gets to that. And this added material included Jesus' explanation of the nature of his kingship. Jesus responded to Pilate's question with another question. Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me? It seems that Jesus may have asked Pilate this question to determine how he would answer him. At least that's our human way of thinking about it. So if Pilate's question had arisen from his own understanding and curiosity, Jesus presumably would have dealt with him as a serious inquirer, if it was, you know, self-generated. If Pilate was merely trying to clarify the essence of the Sanhedrin's charge, then Jesus would need to answer differently. So, if Pilate meant, are you a political king conspiring against Caesar? Because that's what kind of king are you essentially thinking about? The answer would be no. But if he meant, are you the messianic king of Israel? Then the answer would be yes. So while Jesus was the intended object of interrogation, he became the interrogator temporarily. The fact that Jesus questioned Pilate at all was pure grace, in that it allowed Pilate to explain his motivation and perhaps in a sense maybe reduce something of his culpability. And it seems that the grace of God is evident here, and it does and should continue to amaze us even in this context. Pilate responded with indifference and indignance. Pilate's reply clarified that he had no personal interest in Jesus' kingship. In fact, he was indignant that Jesus would suggest such a thing. What do I have to do with the Jews? I'm here not because I want to be, because this is where I was assigned, and I've got to put up with you crazy people, and it's annoying and frustrating, and why can't you just be reasonable and cooperative and get along with everybody? I mean, that's pretty much what they were thinking most of the time. He simply wanted to understand what Jesus was claiming in view of the Sanhedrin's accusation. Beyond that, he wanted to discover why the Jewish leaders were so intent on doing away with Jesus. And his question, "Am I a Jew?" sarcastically denied that Jewish matters such as Jesus' kingship were of any interest to him personally. And we see something of the division between Jew and Gentiles kind of standing out here. Fortunately, we have resolved all of those problems today, right? It continues, and I have heard and read, and you may have as well, that the one factor that is perhaps one of the strongest arguments for the validity of Scripture and the truth of it is the Jew. If you think about it, why are they such a troublesome people? Or why are they so annoying to so many people? Why are they reacted to the degree that they are? But here we have, again, something of that same thing. And it's also ironic here that Jesus was, in fact, Pilate's king in the broader, more universal sense. And Pilate's comment here about Jesus' own people, the nation, handing him over to him, confirmed John's introductory statement way back in chapter 1, verse 11. Jesus came unto his own, and his own did not receive him. And this is a formal acknowledgement of that particular reality. So the answer of Pilate here conveyed the full proof of guilt, of the guilt of Israel. He was indifferent to the situation, essentially. But they were obsessed. And that's what comes out here. They were just absolutely obsessed with getting rid of Jesus. Just like today, there are people who are obsessed with getting rid of Israel. In a very similar parallel way of thinking. This one who represented the power of the world at that time, Pilate, you know, associated with Rome, clearly established and validated that the nation of Israel had rejected their king and sold themselves into the hand of another. And we would see Satan's hand part of that equation. And it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, they were rejecting the promised Mashiach, Messiah, Christ. And you may recall Luke 19:41-44, talking about, because you did not know the time of your visitation. That's what this has reference to as well. Jesus then provided some clarification on the nature of his kingship. He explained that he was indeed a king, as he claimed. However, his kingdom was not the type of kingdom that would compete with Caesar's kingdom by waging war. That's the essence of what he is saying here. It's not the kind of kingdom that's going to stand in the way of Caesar. He wasn't denying that his kingdom was an earthly kingdom. He wasn't saying that it was only a spiritual rule of God in the hearts of his people. He wasn't saying that his kingdom had nothing to do with this world. And it should be clear from the other places that Jesus is referencing his kingdom was it was going to be an earthly kingdom. It's just that it was postponed. So his point was that he and his kingdom were not a threat to Pilate or to Rome. That wasn't his plan. It wasn't his intention. He doesn't have to be concerned about it in that sense. It was non-threatening because God had postponed the Messianic kingdom due to Israel's unbelief, which was essentially validated here. He didn't go through and explain that to Pilate at this point. I don't know if Pilate would have even understood it. There are some among us who don't understand it. This postponed kingdom is still on God's calendar, and it will arrive when the Messiah returns, when the king returns. The Messiah is the anointed one. What is he anointed for? He's anointed to be king. So keep in mind, Messiah relates to his kingship, and that will be taking place at the second coming after the tribulation is culminated. And this arrival will be, at that point, a threat to all competing kingdoms. And then Pilate and any others would have something to think about and be concerned about. Then, looking at verses 37 to 40, Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born." There's the Christmas story right there, in case you missed it. Right there. "For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him at all. But you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" What was Pilate hoping for? He wanted to be done with this. So let's just get this over with. Then they all cried again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. So, what do we see here? The question of the purpose and guilt of Jesus. Jesus affirmed his kingship and his life's purpose. Pilate did not understand the distinctions that Jesus was making between his and Caesar's kingdoms. There was opportunity for him to, but he didn't really pick up on that. He didn't have the depth of understanding to know how to deal with it. But he did understand that Jesus was claiming to have a kingdom. And he next tried to get Jesus to claim unequivocally that he was a king. And Jesus admitted that he was a king. But he needed to say more about his reign if Pilate was to understand the nature of his kingship. So Jesus defined his kingdom negatively, what it's not. And he defined his mission as king positively. The main reason Jesus had come into the world was to bear witness to the truth. By this he meant that he came to reveal God, John 14:6. Jesus produced subjects for his kingdom by revealing God, by calling on people to believe on him, and by giving them eternal life. And this prepared them to participate in his kingdom. Everyone who truly wanted the truth followed Jesus because his teachings had the ring of truth. Jesus' words were an invitation for Pilate to listen to him and to learn the truth. How much was Pilate paying attention here? Was he really thinking that Jesus was anybody to pay attention to? Or was he thinking, how can I get rid of this guy? This is annoying. This is frustrating. And here we see Jesus is showing more interest in appealing to Pilate than he is in defending himself. Interesting to think about. Again, he's concerned for the welfare of others. Pilate questioned the meaning of truth, but denied Jesus' guilt. Obviously, Pilate was not one who truly sought the truth. He turned away from Jesus' offer to reveal it with a cynical comment that truth was essentially unknowable, as many think today, that there is no real absolute truth at all. It's all relative, subjective. And Pilate expressed cynicism due to his experience as a Roman official to whom others constantly lied. They would tell him what he wants to hear rather than what was necessarily true. And it may have been also due to his desire to use the truth to accomplish his own ends, you know, to be a little manipulative, to get what he wants so that he can look good. Not that any of us would ever do that, but that's kind of how things tend to work. So Pilate turned away from the one who not only claimed to reveal the truth, but was in fact the truth in person. When he said, what is truth? Truth was standing right in front of him. He's the truth, the way, and the life. And Pilate wasn't waiting for an answer. John condensed other details found in the synoptics, where Pilate declared Jesus innocent. The Jews accused Jesus further. Jesus replied nothing, and Pilate marveled at Jesus' silence. Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 23. And he simply related Pilate's verdict, I find no guilt in him. And John omitted the account of Jesus' appearance before Herod Antipas that followed this verdict and then preceded Pilate's offer to release Barnabas Barabbas in Jesus' place. And that refers to Luke 23, 6 to 12. So the result of this selection of the material that John elected to communicate and not communicate was to draw the reader's attention to Jesus and Pilate and that dialogue. Because that was really the thing that stood out in the mind of John as he's communicating this to his readers. Because he wanted to show Jesus as the one who was the ultimate authority, standing before the contemporary authority and showing who really was the one in charge. And Pilate felt pressure to find an out for Jesus. So he returned to the Jews who had assembled outside his headquarters and announced his verdict, not guilty. And from what he was evaluating as far as anything punishable by Rome, he had done nothing. So he was guilty of any activity that would be a threat to Rome. There was nothing that stood out to him. And apparently Pilate concluded that Jesus was probably not a king. He may have thought he was, and therefore he was just delusional, and now we just need to get rid of this problem. He may have thought maybe he was just some idealist or whatever. And so this witness to Jesus' innocence was another important testimony that was part of John's argument in his book, part of his purpose to show that Jesus was not guilty of any of the things that had been suggested, that he had been accused of. And then Pilate failed to follow through with his verdict because he just said he's innocent. He's not guilty. So after having displayed a lack of interest in truth, Pilate then revealed a lack of commitment to justice, essentially. And he lacked the courage of his own convictions, or maybe he didn't have as strong convictions in the first place. If Jesus was innocent of all charges, then Pilate should have let him go, regardless of what the Jews were saying. He had no reason, no legal reason, not to. But instead, Pilate began a series of compromising moves to avoid dealing with this situation of a difficult circumstance. And when Pilate found that Jesus was from Galilee, he then sent him to Herod, who happened to be available in town at the time. And then Pilate then had him come back to him shortly thereafter, and he appealed to the crowd again, trying to have some reason to have Jesus released or to remove the pressure of the situation. And so this brings up a question to consider. Why did Pilate refer to this custom of releasing someone, Barabbas here, rather than simply releasing Jesus? Well, I think, and it's been surmised, that it was to draw attention to his own generosity in releasing Jesus. He said, hey, look, I'm going to do you a favor here. This is what I normally do, so now I'm going to do it, and you should take advantage of this. And he wanted the Jews to think good of him, that he was honoring this custom, but in actuality, he was making a big mistake. Except for we know that it wasn't a mistake in the ultimate scheme of things. But he opened the door to the possibility that the Jews did not want to release Jesus. They were already convinced, no matter what was stated, that Jesus had to go. And so they wouldn't accept Jesus as a prisoner release in this situation. And then Pilate referred to him as the King of the Jews, sort of sticking it in just a little bit, getting his insult in to the Jewish leaders, because they vehemently rejected the idea of Jesus being their king, passionately rejected that idea. And so Pilate's acquiescence here set him up for doing something he really didn't want to do. And so he was in this rather uncomfortable position. And he was the authority. He could have said, this is the way it's going to be, but he didn't want to look bad in front of the people that he had to deal with on a regular basis, so Barabbas was turned loose. Which was interesting, because Barabbas had legitimate charges. They had reason to keep him. They didn't have reason to keep Jesus, but they did a switch, which is interesting because there's another element of substitution that's very evident here. Why is that included in the text? Again, another situation. This individual who was legitimately being held, who was an insurrectionist, who was a zealot, a freedom fighter, who was also a robber, as the text says, he was released, and Jesus was the one who was going to be killed in his place. I think it's a very clear picture for us to recognize this. So I think this is an amazing account of someone in authority being manipulated by the people that are under him to accomplish their own political goals in spite of the deviation from proper practice and common sense or courtesy or justice. And the text doesn't specifically state who is behind this incredible injustice, but as we've alluded to already, it's all happening under the oversight of God himself. And it's while Satan is manipulating some of the circumstances, and the people present were making their own culpable choices. and we can learn something of our own tendency here to make bad choices due to less than desirable influences in our lives or evil desires in our hearts. Yet through it all, the will and provision of God was accomplished on our behalf. And there's something to be learned of that. Not only seeing the element of the substitution that is taking place, which is kind of communicated throughout, but it's a reminder that all of this is a fulfillment of what had been predicted throughout the Old Testament, was realized through the incarnation, Christ coming into this world. And now he is coming as the king who is rejected, and Pilate is acknowledging responding to the idea of him being a king and having a kingdom, and yet it was rejected. And it's very clear that the nation was rejecting him, but he was there to provide what was needed for us. And for that, we can be very grateful.